From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Utah Congressman Jim Matheson has been in tough races before. As a Democrat in Utah, he's had to convince voters he's moderate, even conservative on some issues. And for the last six campaigns, it's worked. And it could work again. But Matheson is up against a wave of support for Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney that some believe may swamp his campaign. Matheson told the Deseret News he's used to being an underdog and that he's going to have to be more aggressive and that he's going to have to get his supporters to the polls. Here's how he summed it up. I say, game on. Today in the program, we continue our series of conversations with some of the candidates running for office. Jim Matheson joins us today live from the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our series of conversations with some of the candidates running for office this year. We're live in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics with Democratic Utah Congressman Jim Matheson. The congressman is running for a seventh term of Congress. This time, he's trying it in a new district, the newly created 4th District. He's running against Republican Mia Love, and it's proving to be one of the toughest challenges he's faced, though when you're a Democrat running in Utah, it's always a challenge. We're talking about some of the issues in the race today, and we invite you to join us. We can't take your calls today from the Hinckley Institute, but you can submit questions via email. We're at radiowest@kuer.org. We also invite those of you with us here at the Hinckley Institute to join us. We'll take your questions a little bit later in the program. We should mention we invited Mayor Love to participate in the series. She originally agreed to join us but has since declined. We've reached out to the campaign to ask why. They've declined to give us a reason. Democrat Jim Matheson is serving his 6th term as Utah's 2nd congressional representative in Washington. As I mentioned, now running for the newly created 4th District. Before entering politics, Congressman Matheson worked for 13 years in the energy industry, now serves on the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And Congressman, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks, Doug. It's always good to be with you.
I wanted to start by asking you, I read a profile in the Salt Lake Tribune not so long ago that talked about the 3 years that you spent in Washington, D.C. in the 1980s. Your mother told the paper that experience had a large impact on the decisions that you've made in your life. And I wanted to ask you about that. Is that true, first of all? I mean, did it have an impact?
I don't know. I guess mothers have their own view of how things worked out with their kids. I'm not sure I want to ever disagree with my mom here, but... Look, I think we're all product of our life's experiences. Yeah. I think that you take different paths and different things happen. It affects your perspective. I don't know that I want to put an inordinate amount of weight on my experience, but spending some time in Washington, D.C. in the public policy arena certainly confirmed to me that I have an interest in public policy issues. But quite frankly, I always had that. I grew up in a family that has always been focused on that as well. And those were the conversations around the family dinner table from my earliest memories. But I suspect that having spent some time in that town taught me more about the way the process works, the institutions of government. Also during that time, quite candidly, I took a leave of absence. It was in Utah for one of those years running a political campaign. Right. And so that also had an effect on me, I guess, in terms of giving me different perspective and experience. And so I don't know if I'm giving you the most knowledgeable answer here, but yeah, I'm sure it's helped shape me and what I've done in my life, as of all my other experiences.
Well, I guess the reason I was interested in is how it is that you, when you first were in Washington, your sense of what the proper role of government was, what it could and couldn't do, you know, what its benefits were, what its limitations were, and I'm wondering how that's changed as you've seen it actually.
Well, you're asking me to clear some cobwebs from 30 years ago, Doug, when I was straight out of college. So I don't want to present myself as having a firm sense of every single thing about the proper role of government when I was 22 years old. Sure. But I do think that it taught me that the policy matters. It affects people's lives. That providing good quality information to policymakers is the way ultimately to affect policy in a positive way. I do believe ultimately, despite all the rhetoric and all the spin and all the different things going on in politics, ultimately facts prevail. and the cream rises to the top in terms of good information. And I guess that's what motivated me to be involved. When I was there, I was actually working to eliminate a government agency.
Yeah.
It was an agency that was involved in trying to commercialize certain energy technologies that were immature and not prepared for the commercial stage. And so I suppose that affected me in the context of recognizing where this was a government overreach, an overstep, if you will, in terms of trying to say, it's so important we have this resource, let's just throw a bunch of money at it and see if it would be, these projects would be built at commercial scale. And if the technology's not there, it's just not there. And so, but I was also pleased to be involved in an advocacy role where, at the end of the day, me and others working on it were successful in eliminating a government agency. That doesn't happen too often in our history, actually. And so I was rather proud of the fact we were successful in that regard. And that probably was, the thing I learned from all this is that you should always ask the questions about what's appropriate or not appropriate in terms of the role of government. In this case, I think it was an overstep, and I'm glad we corrected it.
This may be going back to the whole asking you to clear up the cobwebs again, but you were an intern for Speaker Tip O'Neill for a time. Is
that was
right?
When I was in college. My junior and senior year. Yeah.
So I guess I was interested in what, I mean, if you compare the way, you know how it works now, seeing how it worked then, seeing the speaker who was masterful, as many would say, in the way that the system worked. Compare that time to today, if you can remember that.
I think it was less partisan back then.
Yeah.
Not that partisanship hasn't always existed, but there's no question that there was more of a bipartisan dynamic in the House of Representatives, that in my brief time there for a summer internship, I saw him act as Speaker of the House. Not Speaker of one party or the other, Speaker of the House. And that was, and there was great respect for the institution among all people in Congress. And that respect for the institution created greater levels of behavior than some of what you see today in Congress among members of both political parties. And so that was a different time. And in some ways, things have gotten a lot better now than then because we have access to more information and there's more transparency than we had back then. That's all good. But it's hard not also to harken back to the notion that there was a time when statesmanship seemed to occupy a greater role in the way Washington functions than it does today. Mm. And I think most of America wants that. They want that back. And that's something that's always been part of my politics. And it's really affected me. So I think the experience of seeing how everyone treated each other, even when they may disagree on policy X or Y or Z, there was a level of respect that existed in the United States House of Representatives when I was there as an intern that I'd like to see return to our House today.
I know you don't like labels, political labels, but there are things that make you a Democrat. But I'm wondering if you're finding fewer and fewer of those things. And I'm wondering, have you ever in the last, say, 10 years, ever seriously considered becoming a Republican?
No. Look, I am who I am.
Yeah.
I'm a Matheson Democrat. So I've always been. That's who my dad was. I think that we have to be very careful about painting people with a broad brush.
Yeah.
And I think we have to be very careful about describing our politics in a very simplistic two-dimensional context of all Democrats think X and all Republicans think Y. Life isn't that simple. The issues we deal with are not that simple. People have their own points of view. We've gotten too much into the rhetoric that's out there right now on the cable channels that tries to describe the conflict in the most simplistic way, which is in a two-party conflict. What I've found in Congress is there are a lot of people from different backgrounds, different parts of the country, different points of view, and there are lots of ways to look at issues. And so I've always been someone who recognizes that what we ought to do is cast the net out and gather in all the good ideas we can. And we don't really care if it's from someone who happens to be a Republican or a Democrat. Look, the way I was raised, we're all Americans first. And I think we all have a desire for this country to move forward. And I wish that everyone in politics would start with that as their common ground in terms of when we sit down to talk about dealing with issues, is that we all want to move in the same direction.
Yeah.
We all want our country to be better.
But you have to make a call. I mean, you can add up the things that you like about the Republican Party that you agree with, the things of the Democratic Party that you agree with. In the end, you've chosen the Democratic Party. You've always been a Democrat, Matheson Democrat, as you say.
Ever since my great-great-grandmother was appointed the postmistress of Parowan, Utah by Grover Cleveland, I guess our family's been Democrat.
But why did you have picked this part? There are certain things, I imagine, that distinguish Democrats from Republicans, clearly.
Look, I don't like to paint with a broad brush, but I believe everyone in this country ought to be given a good opportunity to succeed. That's a fundamental belief I have that I think we all share. But that's something
distinctive in some ways to the Democratic Party.
I'm not going to try to limit it to one party. I'm just suggesting that's part of why I'm associated with this party.
Got it. You often hear Mayor Mia Love say that you support Barack Obama. And I understand you differ on a number of issues. But when you look at how he's performed as president, net loss, net gain.
There's no question I've had a lot of concerns with what he's done. I've criticized his administration on a number of issues, quite frankly. And in the context of this campaign for Congress, I get it that there's an effort by my opponent to try to nationalize this race and make it a proxy for a presidential race. This is nothing new in Utah politics. They did it to my dad. They tried to make him seem like he was Jimmy Carter. And my dad isn't Jimmy Carter. And I'm not a Barack Obama. My opponent is not Mitt Romney. I'll tell you that. And so I think when people are voting for president, that's one spot on the ballot. When they're voting for Congress, they're different names on the ballot. And I hope people pay attention to where those individuals are on all the issues that matter to us.
You did an interview with Thomas Burr back in March. He's a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. He asked you if you were going to vote for President Obama. Here's what you told him at the time. You said, yes, I'm going to vote for the president. I've had many issues where I've disagreed with him, and people are aware of that. And as a congressman, my mantra is always put Utah first. But in this election, that's who I'm going to vote for. You still feel that way? You're still going to vote for the president?
Yeah, this is no big secret. The bottom line is, again, if we want to try to nationalize this race, then last I saw, we don't have a parliamentary system of government in this country. We have a representative form of government in this country, and people choose who they want to represent them. And I'm convinced that in the 4th Congressional District, if people look at where me and my opponent are on the significant issues they care about, there are some huge differences. And I think they're going to be far more comfortable with me as their representative.
Well, we're going to talk about those differences, but I want to get the question out of the way. State Senator Scott Howell was on the program last week. Wouldn't answer that question. He wouldn't say who he would vote for.
Yeah, and I've been real clear. And besides that, as I've said before, if you want to have a president be successful, whoever it is, they can't suffer from the gridlock that's in Washington today in Congress. That's a problem. And if in a Romney presidency, for him to be successful, he is going to need some statesmanlike people on the other side of the aisle. I'll be the first to reach across the aisle to try to help him be successful, just like I was with President Bush. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, I think we're all Americans, and we want to succeed and all move in the same direction.
Okay. You are voting for President Obama, though. Is that what you said?
This has been clear all along.
That you are.
There's no big secret here.
Okay. It wasn't clear to me. So now it is. Good. I want to get your thumbnail impression, if you would. How you assess what happened in 2007, 2008, in terms of the economic collapse. What's your sort of basic sense of what it is that happened?
Well, I think it's dangerous to oversimplify. That happens a lot in the business of public policy. But the fundamental issues that led to this problem were we had a mortgage market that was rife with speculation. As a result, you had a speculative bubble grow in the housing market, in the mortgage market. And what I mean by speculative bubble, it means it had prices and actions taking place that are outside of what the market would normally support. And the bubble grew extremely large. And if you want to point the finger of blame, you could point it in a whole lot of different directions. A lot of folks were looking for something more than what was appropriate from market pricing, for example. And I think that the ultimate challenge that allowed this bubble to grow so big was the fact that Wall Street was taking any mortgage product they could find. They were slicing and dicing it into different products and derivatives and spreading it out over the globe. And so there was an end point where you could dump all these bad products. And so everyone along the chain, from an individual who's probably buying a house more than they could afford, they got a loan approved without even providing documentation. The bank said, we'll approve it because we can flip this mortgage and it's not on our books anymore. The mortgage broker, whoever it was, everybody in the supply chain could move that product up to a point where there was a place where it could land. And yet the fundamental economics underlying those mortgages were out of whack. And so ultimately, and it took a while, The bubbles, as they always do in market economics, bubbles do burst. You had Wall Street firms leveraged 40-50 to 1, which is way outside of what conventional business practices would argue is a responsible thing to do. And so, again, not to repeat too much, but while you could point the finger of blame in a lot of directions, in my opinion, the bubble is allowed to grow so large because there was a place where all these bad products could be accepted. And I believe the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is responsible for keeping an eye on Wall Street, was not doing its job. And I think they were looking the other way. And I think that's what got us into this mess.
So when you think about the government's role in what happened, or let's move on to how you resolve or fix the problems, what do you think the government's role is now? Dodd-Frank, for example, is one method. What do you think about reforms like that?
Look, I think it's important to have a referee on the field. I happen to believe in the power of market economics and private sector innovation and a capitalist system, but you got to have a referee on the field. If there's no referee on the field, things get out of whack. And so there's a zone of reasonableness out there. Some people, there are times when we have too much regulation. There are times when we don't have enough. In the politics of the moment we have today, people like to talk in all or none phrases all the time. This is one where we really shouldn't. And it's one where we should look to have an appropriate role in terms of being a referee to make sure everyone plays by the rules. That's easier said than done. It's hard to draw a bright line for where you get it perfect. And circumstances in our economy based on technology and globalization are changing all the time. So you have to be capable of modifying the role of that referee over time as well. But there is no question that this has been an exceptionally hard body blow to the U.S. economy. Worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. I personally know people who've lost their homes. I know people are underwater on their mortgages now. And it's been tough for this economy to recover because that bubble got so big before it burst. And so I hope this is a teaching moment for all of us as a society about making sure that we look for opportunities that are reasonable, that if it sounds too good to be true, maybe it is. And it's important to have, as I said, an appropriate referee on the field to make sure everyone plays by the rules.
I want to ask you about the budget. I'm going to quote something the University of Utah political science professor Thad Hall has said. He was interviewed by Robert Gerke of the Tribune. He said this. He said, the idea that we're going to balance the budget and not cause anybody pain and only give away more tax cuts to people and only cut waste, fraud, or abuse is nuts. It cannot happen. The math does not work. What do you think about that? What's your response to that? The idea that in order to get out of this particular situation, it's going to take more than just, you know, cutting some deductions here or there, cutting some waste and fraud here and there, that it's going to take some major sacrifice.
I think that most people in this country recognize that we need to have some level of shared sacrifice among everyone in terms of getting our budget back in balance. It's clear to me that there is a need to reduce spending. Quite frankly, I voted to cut over almost $3 trillion of spending already. And I believe that you can't do that without having some people feel some impact from that. That's a fact. The charge for people in the public policy arena is to come up with a responsible and equitable way to go about doing this where there is a true sense of shared sacrifice, right, and that we're not picking on some over others. And I think that is the great challenge we face. If you really
what do you mean by that in particular? Can you cite something?
Well, I think you have to say, you know, some people say, well, this should be off limits,
yeah,
or that should be off limits. In my opinion, to at least have an honest negotiation, everything ought to be on the table. Now, at the end of the day, it may be a prudent decision to say this should happen and that shouldn't, and you got to prioritize and make decisions. But to argue that things shouldn't even be put on the table for discussion is really not a way to have a comprehensive discussion about what we ought to be talking about. I believe that if you really look at the challenge of spending at the federal level, the number one driver of the deficit on the spending side really is healthcare costs.
Yeah.
And it's the growth in healthcare costs over time that should be of greatest concern to people. And by the way, that's not limited to, that doesn't mean that's a problem that's just limited to federal budget issues. That's a challenge to our private sector in the United States as well. It makes us less competitive with the rest of the world if our health care costs continue to grow at a greater rate than inflation. Now, right now, we're spending, roughly 50% more per capita than the next highest country in the world on health care. So we already spend more than everybody else. And it's a burden that in a global economy that our private sector feels. So to me, if you want to talk about, and every dollar should be scrutinized and every program should be looked at, don't get me wrong, but yeah. I'm suggesting that if you really want to look at the large component out there, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans, health care, that's a big driver of the federal budget deficit.
Here's this question that was put to the Republican presidential candidates at a debate in Iowa. This was back in August of last year. You've heard it. It's become kind of an infamous question. Fox News' Bret Baier asked it. He said, say you had a deal, a real spending cuts deal, 10 to 1.
Yeah.
10
yeah.
spending cuts to one increase in revenue.
Right.
And he asked if they would take that deal. Now no one would. They all said they would not take that deal. How do you respond to that question?
Well, I think, first of all, when you hear a magnitude of 10 to 1, a lot of people would say that doesn't sound so bad. And secondly, when we talk about where I think there are opportunities for revenue increases, I actually think that a lot of folks, including the Simpson-Bowles Deficit Reduction Commission, I might add, have suggested that we actually have an opportunity to lower tax rates but close loopholes in a context that would actually result in revenue growth for this country over time. Filling in the details on that, I will acknowledge, is a lot more complicated than everyone's making it out to be. But there is at least some level of bipartisan consensus that approach can work. And I have talked to people in the House of Representatives on the Republican side of the aisle who say if we lower rates and broaden the base and that increases revenue, they don't think that's a tax increase because rates are going down. And so I think that if you put it in that broader context of reforming the tax code, I think there is an opportunity to have a stronger revenue base, if you will, in this country that helps with the deficit. I think everything's got to be on the table in that context. And I think that the $10 of spending cut to $1 revenue increase, if the revenue increase, I got to qualify to how you do that revenue increase is important. But if it's in a context where I think rates are going down, who would not agree with that?
Let's say you raise taxes on those making $1 million a year. What do you say about that?
I think that the discussion we're having in this country is not very accurate on that issue, because if you look at the way our tax code is used in this country, we have two codes. We have a corporate code and we have an individual code. But what's interesting is the majority of business entities in America don't pay under the corporate tax code. They pay under the individual code. And so $1 million might sound like a lot of money if it's an individual making it. But if you're a small business with 23 employees and you got $1 million of revenue, that's not that much. And that's one of the great unfortunate aspects of the discussion about tax policy, is we're overlooking the fact that the majority of businesses, entities in America are paying under the same tax code as individuals, and you're sweeping them all into one category. And I don't think that's right. And I think we ought to have a more thoughtful and deliberative discussion in more detail level about how our tax policies are structured. By the way, our tax code hasn't been updated since 1986. It's completely out of date with the 21st century economy we're in right now. And by the way, as a result, I think there are huge opportunities in the context of tax reform to modernize our tax code in a way which I think would be great for our economy. It's stunning in our corporate code. I'll just give one quick example. That right now, we're one of only five countries in the world that doesn't recognize, in a global economy, your domestic companies are selling product offshore, and we ought to reward them for that. And if we want the money to come back here, their profits. We have a tax policy that keeps profits offshore. We've got over $2 trillion estimated of U.S. private sector profit parked offshore, because if it comes back here, it gets double taxed. And that's why I'm the lead Democrat and Kevin Brady's the lead Republican on a bill that's called the Repatriation Bill that would allow that money to come back to the U.S., because I'd rather have that $2 trillion here than offshore. But that's just one quick example. U.S. is one of only five countries in the world that taxes overseas profits that way. We're so antiquated in that regard. And if we update the tax code, I think it provides a platform for greater economic growth and opportunity.
You hear Mitt Romney say that now, in a time of economic difficulty, now is not the time to increase taxes on what he calls job creators. As you mentioned, some of these small business owners who may fit into that category. Yeah. But do you think that there could be a category of those more wealthy Americans, certainly the higher end of Americans, who should get, to help in this revenue equation, a tax hike.
Actually, here's what I think we ought to do. I think in the short run, because all these tax cuts expire December 31, we ought to extend them all. They're going to be extended for another temporary period of time, which is part of the problem we're in, is this temporary policy. But during that temporary period of time, it's time finally to really say, instead of putting Band-Aids around the edges of a tax code that doesn't make any sense or is sorely outdated, let's really overhaul our tax code. That's really what we ought to be doing.
So you can't really – so it's hard for you to identify those who should pay more or less until you have a sense of reforming the flawed
system. Hey, I told
system.
You. I'm a big believer. Overall, I think rates can go down. I think a flatter tax code with fewer loopholes is actually going to be something that creates greater confidence in our tax code. It's going to be greater transparency. Right now, does anybody in America think the tax code's very fair? And do they understand it? I think everyone thinks it's way too confusing. And so I think if we take the steps I've suggested, and this isn't my idea alone. In fact, on the corporate tax level, Romney and Obama are saying the same thing. Let's lower rates, close loopholes. They're saying exactly that. Neither of them have filled in any details, I might add. Yeah. But at least at the 100,000-foot level, they're saying the same thing. And so I think that's the next step to take, as opposed to trying about little adjustments here and there on a tax code that, in my opinion, is completely out of date.
Does Paul Ryan's budget plan go too far?
Yeah. It doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't really balance the budget. It also takes an approach with Medicare that doesn't address solving the underlying problems of health care cost growth in America. It just says, okay, senior citizen, the government's going to mail you a voucher in the mail. You go out and negotiate with the insurance company to get your own insurance, and if costs go up, that's your problem. So I don't think that's the way you address the issue. I think the way to address the issue is let's talk about healthcare delivery system reform in a way where we can try to control this growth in healthcare costs over time, and that's good for America if we do that.
Another one of those recommendations, of course, in the Ryan plan is to repeal the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Mm-hmm. You voted against the repeal initially, and you said you did that because you wanted to wait until the Supreme Court had made a ruling on that. Then you voted to repeal it. Didn't vote for the president's Affordable Health Care Act. Mm-hmm. Where are you on this idea of the effect of Obamacare on the budget as a whole? There's some dispute about the effects. Where are you on that score?
I don't think it addresses the underlying problems we have. I don't think it addresses the problems of excessive growth in healthcare costs. And ultimately, I think that's the issue we need to address. I think we all, most of us in this country, regardless of party, have a goal of having people in this country have access to affordable health care. I think that's a laudable goal that we all share. The question is, how do you get there? And I think that the Obamacare legislation took a step at part of the access side, although not everyone gets access, by the way, but it didn't address the cost side. And I think we need to have a more substantive discussion than what took place on the Affordable Care Act. And we have to have more of a bipartisan component, and we have to have more of the stakeholders throughout the healthcare delivery system engaged in addressing this issue. It's the most complicated issue there is, in my opinion. I think healthcare delivery system reform is remarkably complicated. And, you know, politics is a business where people like to come up with the 10-second answer or something you can fit on a bumper sticker. There's no 10-second answer to this one. And there's not one or two or three things that have got to happen. There are probably hundreds and hundreds of variables we ought to look at in terms of how we can create a healthcare system that works more effectively, efficiently, has more cost accountability than what we've got right now. And that's the discussion we ought to be having. And I think we're going to have that discussion regardless of what people think about Obamacare. I don't think it solves the underlying issue that I'm raising about cost growth. And we're going to have that discussion as a country. And it ain't going to be easy. It ain't going to be easy. And so you hear a lot of people talking about what they don't like. They got to talk about what they want to do instead. I mean, I'll give you a couple of ideas on that if you want. I think that clearly we ought to do malpractice reform. We have 30% of procedures in this country are not medically necessary. 30%. It's incredibly wasteful. It's not all because people are afraid of being sued. Don't get me wrong. Again, I'm not trying to give the simple answer here. But one piece of it is we ought to recognize that we have docs, hospitals, home health care providers, whoever, are afraid of being sued, and they do excessive procedures to cover their backside. And that is not good. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office has already scored a bill that Congress voted on for malpractice reform, something I supported, that says it would save Medicare $57 billion over 10 years. So that's one area we could talk. We could talk also about the fact that we have a healthcare system where it's based on a model called fee for service, which is means the more you do, the more you make. And it's an industry where you're paid for quantity more than quality. And as a patient, I think I want quality. I think we all want quality in our healthcare delivery system. And this is a complicated issue about how you modify the compensation structure in healthcare system today. And I'm not saying everyone in the system's greedy at all. I'm just saying that the incentives that exist there today encourage doing more as opposed to encourage doing well.
That's a conversation
we ought to have.
Right. There's a component, of course, in Governor Romney's healthcare reform in Massachusetts and in the Affordable Care Act that suggests that people should be forced to buy health insurance. Where are you on that?
Now, you're going to have to say be forced to buy. What you mean all individuals are forced to buy?
There's a mandate.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I thought you wanted, we're getting rid of the employer.
There is a mandate.
Yeah. Right now we have the individual I mean, mandate. We have employer-sponsored health care insurance in this country, but the idea is that everybody would be in the pool. The concern I have with the way that was structured in the Affordable Care Act in particular is I think it was remarkably unfair to younger folks because there was a fixed ratio for what the differential could be in premiums between someone in their 20s and someone in their 60s. Whereas the impact on healthcare costs, of course, the person in their 60s has far greater costs than the person in their 20s. And so it was an intergenerational transfer, once again, where young people were getting forced to pay far more in than what actuarially they even ought to be paying in. I get the broader concept that insurance is where we all pool our risk. I think we all get that. I think there's a better way to go about it than mandating it, particularly with the ratios that force younger people to have to do massive subsidies to folks who are older than them. I don't think that's fair.
Congressman Jim Matheson is with us, the sixth term representative from Utah's second congressional district, running, of course, for the newly created fourth congressional district. We're live in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, the University of Utah, and we invite you to join us. If you have a question, you can send it via email. We'll also invite those of you here with us in the caucus room to ask questions when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're back at the Hinckley Institute of Politics as we continue our series of conversations with some of the candidates running for office. Today, Utah Congressman Jim Matheson is joining us, and he is running against Republican Mia Love, the mayor of Saratoga Springs, in the newly created 4th Congressional District. You can join us via email, radiowest@kuer.org. And we'd also like to invite those of you here, if you have questions, just raise your hands. We've got a microphone. We can get that to you. Let's take a question from Steve Cruz, actually. He's back in the back.
All right, Congressman Matheson, public education is something we haven't talked about yet today, and it's mostly the domain of state and local agencies. But the federal government has a growing role, especially since the implementation of the No Child Left Behind Act in the last decade. What do you see as the federal government's role in public education? Has No Child Left Behind gone too far? What should the federal government be doing to help Utah have a better education system?
Well, first of all, I believe that our tradition in this country, and it's the right tradition, is that curriculum and administrative decisions in our education system are done at the local level. And that is appropriate, and I think that's the way it should be. No Child Left Behind, this was President Bush's number one initiative when he was running for president in 2000. The goal was we want everyone to be accountable, make sure no one's slipping through the cracks. That's a good goal. In terms of implementation, it's got some problems. And without getting too much in the weeds, let me offer three quick fixes that I think we ought to have with No Child Left Behind. Number one, the way we measure teacher accountability through test scores is too rigid. Utah has come up with its own method of doing this called the individual growth model. And finally, because Congress won't act on No Child Left Behind, the administration has offered a waiver to Utah to measure in a more appropriate way. Secondly, the definition of highly qualified teachers. We all want qualified. That sounds like a good thing. We want qualified teachers, of course, in our classroom, the way the legislation is written. Among other things, you have to have a college major in the subject that you're teaching. particularly in rural Utah, you have teachers teaching multiple subjects. That's not a particularly realistic way to say they're qualified. Third, we got to be real careful about how it handles special education. Special education is in a category where when it comes to measuring progress and accountability, we should acknowledge it's special education. And these are kids that have different needs and different capabilities, and the legislation, I think, is too rigid in that regard. But beyond your specific question about No Child Left Behind, I think we ought to talk about what the role is. And I think the role ought to be not telling states what to do. The role ought to be making sure every kid in this country has an opportunity to have a good education. And quite frankly, that's what the role's been. Been that way in terms of making sure that in poor communities where the tax base is low, they're under something called Title I, where there's additional funding to help those schools have the resources to make sure kids have opportunity to have a good education. When it comes to special education, again, a different category of kids requires some extra resources, and there's been a federal role in helping fund special education. So for K through 12, those are the primary roles that have existed that I think are good to have, is making sure that we level the playing field for everyone in America to have an opportunity. My opponent wants to eliminate the Department of Education, wants to get rid of this funding. I don't think that's good policy. I think that's backward policy. I think that's taking away opportunity from people, because it will take away what right now is a more level playing field. Now, we also, since you mentioned education, we ought to talk about higher ed. Once you go through, you want to go to some type of post-secondary education, what's the federal role been? It's really been the role of financial aid. It hasn't been setting policy, hasn't been setting curriculum. It's offered work study, it's offered grants, it's offered student loans. This is another key issue in this campaign, because my opponent thinks we ought to get rid of all those things. Over 75% of all college students in Utah are on some form of federal aid. And this is our investment in the future. If we want to pull the rug out from people wanting to go to college, we got a bigger deficit problem in the long run. Because if we don't have a well-educated population, it's that much more difficult for this country to compete in what is an increasingly competitive global economy. It's a fundamental issue.
When you hear Mayor Love talk about this idea of, you know, stripping out funding for Pell Grants and student loans and those kinds of things, she hasn't been terribly detailed, so I'm not exactly sure what she means, but she talks about that somehow the private sector needs to be involved more in the higher education system that would somehow bring costs down, which I suppose you can respond to if you like. But I guess the question is, why are tuition costs going up so much, and what can, if anything, the federal government do about that beyond just extending more loans to students?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure what she's talking about when it comes to some private sector solution to lower tuition costs. I'd be interested to know, but the reality is this is a position that I have yet to meet one person in Utah, one person other than my opponent, who thinks we ought to get rid of federal student loans, grants, and work study. Not one, because so many families in Utah have taken advantage of this. Now, I recognize the challenge of rising college costs, and they've grown at a greater rate than inflation, and that is a great concern. We ought to have a concern for all of us. I haven't heard any solutions, by the way, from my opponent. Is the government supposed to take some action to lower tuition costs? I don't think that we should be setting prices. I don't think we want price controls from the government. That's not a good idea, in my opinion.
So you don't see a mechanism to really fix this from the government?
Let me just say, I'm all for looking for mechanisms if they're out there. I don't know that it's government's role to do this. We have a competitive marketplace. There are a lot of colleges, a lot of post-secondary options out there that students can choose from. We have different choices now. There are different choices. There are different paths people can take, and there's a competitive dynamic out there that hopefully does address these issues of trying to keep costs down. What I'm suggesting is this. I don't think we want to pull away grants, work, study, and loans. I just think that that's bad policy.
Any more questions here? Raise your hand and we'll get to you. We're getting a mic to this gentleman here. There is a question that comes via email. What are your thoughts about Mitt Romney and his comment about cutting public television? And he put in parentheses, Big Bird. It's a question mark. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, I acknowledge we have a spending problem as a country that we need to address, and I think every dollar and every expenditure needs to be scrutinized. I happen to have talked with a lot of folks in Utah about the value of public television. The children's programming is a big deal in Utah households. It's not clear to me that we would have that without PBS. So as a tiny fraction of the budget, I think that it is something that we should want to support because I think it helps our communities. And can I just say an anecdotal story on this? This is kind of interesting. In my time in Congress, you know, sometimes the phone rings off the hook at the office on an issue and you can tell when it's manufactured by certain interest groups and you can tell when it's organic just from regular citizens calling in. And I'm telling you, we had a vote in the House of Representatives a few years ago to cut public broadcasting funding. It's the most phone calls we ever got. It was unbelievable how many people from Utah called about this because they care about it so much.
Another question from the audience. Go ahead.
First and foremost, thank you, gentlemen, for presenting such a dialogue.
Sure.
I sincerely appreciate it. Throughout my international travels, I've met students from Senegal, Liberia, and even North Korea. And what seems to separate their students from the majority of American students is the X factor. And the X factor can primarily be boiled down to desire, to place an importance on academic studies. Growing up in high school here, you know, I didn't really put too much fruition in academics because, you know, I thought the only financial gain, or excuse me, the only benefits from academics was financial gain. However, now growing up, I was embarrassed in traveling internationally as to see how much I not know. Is there any programs that you will be initiating in regards to putting an importance on academics for all students?
Well, I think there are a couple answers to your question. First of all, I'll say what I did before. One of the things great about this country is everybody gets a shot at a good education. And in other countries around the world, that's not the case. And there may be some high performers that do really well from these countries, but a lot of the population doesn't even have access to good education. And so we should celebrate the fact, first of all, that in America, we think everybody gets an opportunity. Now, how do we make sure that people understand the great value of that opportunity? How do we encourage people to take advantage of it? You know, I don't think that's necessarily a government policy that should be doing that. I think we want to make sure that we have students, families, everyone continue to be informed about the true values of pursuing as much education as you can in your life. And it's not just, you know, economics are an easy metric to measure that by. There are other metrics, too, about what it just means to a society, to have a well-educated society. It's part of why America is the superpower it is, by the way. So I think that we need to encourage that type of discussion because what is happening, and you have sort of validated this in your question, too, is it's a competitive world out there. And while the United States historically has had the best university system in the world by far and great academic performance, the rest of the world wants to be like us. They all want to be like America. And they want to, and they've made efforts to get there. And so for all the good work we may have done in the past, I think it's always important for us to redouble our efforts and reaffirm the value of that education. And so I appreciate your question, but I don't think there's some government policy that's going to change that. I think it's going to have to be just a general awareness we have as a society that more education makes us better off.
Thanks. Another question. Go ahead.
Thank you both for being here today. You touched earlier briefly on partisan politics in Washington, and I was just wondering how you feel about campaign finance's role in creating some of that partisanship, and do you think that anything should change in that arena,
sure,
the Grover Norquists of the world and kind of their influence on people's views?
First of all, I think that I think we're all troubled by the amount of money in politics. The new Supreme Court rulings create a situation where there's unlimited amounts of third-party money. You're seeing it in this race right now. I'd rather it be in a discussion between the candidates and the voters. And the concern I have is the echo chamber is getting more and more participants in it besides the candidates. And in some respects, as a result, the candidates are getting shoved off on the sideline. And that's unfortunate. I will also say that in the world we're in now, where technology's taken us in terms of 24/7 capability to communicate lots of information, and many ways in an unfiltered manner, there are a lot of interests out there that are trying to spin people up. And the old days where perhaps everything went through what we call traditional media and there was more fact-checking, now in the digital world, anything goes. And there's a lot of misinformation out there. And it really was going to require all of us. And I think, and I have great confidence, actually, that the public's figured this out, that they take a lot of this with a grain of salt that they're hearing out on the in the digital world. And I often think that people see through a lot of that mess. But I'm not going to deny to you that the partisanship has been enhanced, I think, by the real-time nature of information, where it creates a harsher edge to the dialogue. But I'm also going to suggest that if my review of the Constitution and the article that describes the legislative function, the way our Constitution is structured, you got to have consensus to get things done. You just do. Just about every major policy decision that's been made in America legislatively in our history, not all of them, but a lot of them, have been done in a bipartisan consensus-building way, because that's the way you get things done. And so when you see gridlock in Washington, not a lot happening, it's because the Constitution is still working. And what's happening across America right now, and there are all kinds of studies that show this, is people are registering more and more as independents. They're not happy with either party. I don't blame them.
The Supreme Court, though, in that Citizens United ruling, they suggested that all the spending that's going on amounts to free speech. Are they wrong about that?
Look, I'm all for free speech. I think we all are. I'm just suggesting that in the political dialogue, we are crowding out the candidates from having a discussion with potential voters and constituents, and that's the great concern I have. There are a couple of steps you could take on this, by the way. First of all, I think at a minimum, we ought to at least have to disclose where all the money's coming from. I do, for my campaign. You can look it up on the internet and see all my donors. But there are these various third-party groups out there that don't. And some of them are advocating on my behalf, and some are advocating for my opponent. But I'm just suggesting, aren't we all better off at least holding them accountable about who's funding these efforts? I think we should. And that's one step that doesn't address the bigger issue you're talking about, Doug, which is the free speech issue. Seems to me the only way to address that issue, if you want to change the way things are, is you've got to amend our Constitution, which I think is a pretty tall order and not going to happen.
Let's take another question here from the audience. Gentlemen.
Thank you, too, for being here. I just have a quick question. Do you think that candidates for Congress and for the presidency have pushed their views farther to either side to appeal to their base instead of focusing on the issues? Do you think that could be contributing to the gridlock, that congressmen are too focused on getting reelected rather than getting actual policy through?
I think it's an interesting question. In the context of where a lot of congressional districts in America have been created by drawing of the boundaries on the maps in a way where that one party is always going to win the district, it's created a lack of two-party competition. And in fact, it means the party primary process decides who the member of Congress is going to be. And often the more extreme elements of the party dominate that process. And so across America, you have this balkanized system of congressional districts where the vast, probably almost 400 of them aren't in play in this election. And that means these extreme elements of both parties tend to dominate the nominating process early on in the spring. That picks who's going to win in November. It's a done deal. So I would suggest that is a challenge in a lot of different races. That's not necessarily a challenge for me. I don't have a district that's drawn in my favor from a partisan standpoint at all. But I would suggest across America that the challenge that you've talked about is the phenomenon you've talked about is real, and it's created perhaps some more extreme elements in the United States House of Representatives than what existed years ago. People have gotten very sophisticated on this way they draw boundaries. Now, the one upside that I can tell you for the future is that some states have decided to do something different. California went to an independent commission to draw the boundaries this year, and I know this is a process discussion, and sometimes it gets people once every 10 years, but it really matters how you set the framework of the debate. And I think it would be a good step if we all went to independent commission.
Thanks a lot. Yes, in the back.
Congressman, we've been talking some more bigger picture with campaign finance or partisan politics. But with student loans, you kind of touched on a distinction between you and your opponent. As somebody that votes in your district mm-hmm. and will be voting again, could you help draw a distinction to the choice that I'll make when I go to the voting polls this fall?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'll draw a distinction on a few issues, and I'll draw a distinction on overall approach. Let's start with approach. I'm the kind of guy who's always looking for a good idea where it comes from. I always work in a bipartisan way, and I'm not beholden to any. I put my decisions above party leaders or party or personal celebrity or anything else. I think my opponent's just going to walk the party line. And so on approach, I think that's the big difference. On issues, we've touched on a real important one is the value of education. I believe that it's important for kids in this country to have an opportunity to succeed. I think we need a level playing field for kids. I also think college students need to have an opportunity to afford college. My opponent wants to eliminate the Department of Education altogether, wants to get rid of all college aid. That's a pretty big difference. On taxes, she has a record of raising taxes. 1 year in her hometown, property taxes went up 116% in 1 year. Property taxes in her town are higher than all the towns around it. I've got a record of lowering taxes. I think that's a big issue. When it comes to Medicare, she supports the plan that will go to the voucher system. I don't think that addresses the underlying problem of health care cost growth. I think it just tells seniors, you're on your own, go out and find your best deal, and if costs go up, you're on your own. I don't think that solves the problem. On Social Security, she's talked about privatizing it, going to individual accounts. I don't think that's a good idea. I think that we ought to have a collective trust fund for Social Security. I think that's the role that it has filled for a long time. It's been a remarkably successful program. A lot of people have been paying into that for a lot of years, and they've earned that benefit, and I don't think we should go back on that. So I've given you four issues and a general approach as differences that I'd ask you to consider in this race. And I got to tell you something. None of us are happy with the way the gridlock is taking over Congress. At least I'm not happy. I'm not happy with it. But I have a reputation as being a voice of reason. And people on both sides of the aisle know that about me. And when it comes to talking about Utah issues, they know that I talk about it because I care about it on the substance and not based on what some party leader says from either party. And I think that at the end of the day, if you want to get something done in that town, that's the right way to do it.
Let me mention, a recent Deseret News KSL TV poll shows the race pretty close. Mia Love is ahead in the poll by some 6 points. If you take into account the margin of error, she's up by just one. But if you look at the polling taken back in June, there's a 21-point swing in this race to her favor. Why do you think that is finally, and what's your strategy to surmount that?
Well, first of all, I think there are a lot of polls out there these days, and I've always anticipated it would be a close race. This is a district that was drawn specifically to beat me. They took away my current district, split it up three different ways. It doesn't exist anymore. And I think I've had a couple of $1 million of negative ads on TV beating up on me. And I think that that obviously was going to tighten the race. And I've always anticipated it would be a tight race. Whether it tightens because of the negative ads in September or it tightens later on in October, it was going to get to where it is anyway. And so this is nothing that is a surprise to me. I always run based on assuming it's a tight race because I've had a few in my career. I'm used to this. And there's no big strategic shift for me at all. I am going to talk to voters about the issues that I care about. I'm going to talk about my vision of the future, and I'm going to work hard for every vote, and that's just what I do. And at the end of the day, I think that Utahns are thoughtful about how they vote and look at each race on its merits, and that's the plan going forward.
Utah Congressman Jim Matheson. Congressman, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Doug. Always appreciate it.
Let me mention again, we invited Mayor Love to participate in this series. She had originally agreed to join us, but has since declined. We've reached out to the campaign to provide a reason, which they've also declined to give. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark, mixed today by KUER's engineer, Lewis Downey. Our thanks, of course, to all the folks here at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. I'm Doug Fabrizio.